going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. He was notorious. Raful Edmond, the convicted drug kingpin during D.C.'s murder capital of America days. Now, federal prosecutors say because of Edmond's cooperation with authorities, his life sentence should be reduced. Earlier this year, a motion for early release was filed by the U.S. Attorney in the District of Columbia. Well, tonight, as we look at these new developments, we ask, is redemption enough? Should Raful Edmond be released or remain behind bars? My guests are Keith Alexander, Washington Post reporter, who covered the Edmond trial in 1984 and today's hearing. Also, Javeda Smith, author of Get Yourself Together, Furtive Events from the Diary of a Child of a Crack Addict, and James Ziegler. He is a defense attorney who worked with young men impacted by the drug epidemic. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You're certainly welcome to tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Thank you all for coming in. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Let me start with you, Keith. Give me the Cliff Notes version of Raful Edmond. Who is he? Who was he?
Well, first let me start. I did not cover the trial. I was actually a college student right here at Howard University during the trial.
Oh, okay.
So, journalism major, so I did not actually cover the trial. What I did cover, what I have been covering since February, is when the federal prosecutors basically shocked the entire city and said, you know what, Raful Edmond has been cooperating with us for the past 20 years and is responsible for hundreds of arrests and convictions of individuals up and down the East Coast, and not just in Washington, D.C. And because of that cooperation, prosecutors believe that his life without parole sentence should be reduced. Now, as you said, Harold, you know, Raful Edmond was indeed a drug kingpin. He was a stereotype. He was the one who, you know, had the flash, the diamonds. He had would take private flights to Beverly Hills and to New York to just do shopping sprees. He would carry money around, wads of money around with him on the streets of Northeast D.C., which is where he lived, and just hand out $100 bills to kids. He was very much, he was revered, but he also had a posse, if you will, of drug dealers who around the city were selling drugs. He was also connected to hundreds of murders. Now, he was never convicted of any of the murders, but he was associated, if you will, with many of these murders. So, as you said, he ushered in a time when the District of Columbia was known as the murder capital of the country, and because he was out there selling these drugs. And so, it's very interesting now. If you fast forward, here we are, you know, 30 years later, and now the very people. The very people who called him the worst thing to ever happen to Washington, D.C., are now saying he now deserves to get out of prison a little bit sooner.
In the 1980s, I was in college, but I came home to the D.C. metro frequently. I had my ear to the ground to what was happening in Washington, even though I was just up the road in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And before he was arrested, before he was convicted, they called D.C. Dodge City. They called it the bad old days because there was literally blood running in the street.
Bodies in the street.
Bodies in the street. That is not an exaggeration.
It is not. And what's also not an exaggeration, I came down here in 87 during the time of his reign. He was arrested in 89. Mm-hmm. And I remember when you would drive around the city and every stop sign or red light you came to, dudes would come up to you selling drugs. You could not, every other block, at a stop sign, dudes would come into your car. You want to buy this? You want to buy? What are you trying to buy? everywhere you went. It was also very fascinating is that a lot of those, of these million-dollar homes all around D.C. were crack houses at the time. They were abandoned crack houses. D.C. was unrecognizable back then as it is today. And now these homes are now multi-million-dollar homes. Even the neighborhood where Ray Poitman lived and grew up. Multi-million-dollar homes in the place where he was selling drugs.
Yeah, the murder rate was upwards of 400 a year. There were open air drug markets. It was a very difficult place to live, particularly if you lived east of the river. That was a difficult place. From your perspective, James, as a defense attorney, you worked with young men who have been impacted by, you know, by the drug epidemic. What is your perspective on how their lives have been affected?
So it's interesting. My clients, and I have represented several and continue to represent quite a few, are people, are grown men now, you know, not much younger than Rafel, who were given, most of them, life sentences in the early 1990s. And they were juveniles at the time. You know, so these were teenagers who were, in a lot of respects, consumed by the violence and the devastation that, you know, that the crack crisis brought with it, but also that kind of lingered in the wake. Even as crack began to recede, a lot of the violence kind of stuck around, and young people were really kind of, I think, some of the biggest victims of that. And so many of my clients now, under a recent D.C. law, are seeking sentence reductions themselves, just like Rafel is. But the basis for their sentence reductions is different. Their basis is, well, we were children, we were juveniles at the time, and so the law says you should treat us differently. And unlike in Rafel's case, the United States Attorney's Office opposes sentence reductions in all of their cases. So all the men I work with, and it is all men, are watching this Rafel story unfold, and they're saying, hey, wait a minute. He was, you know, the big fish who was more responsible than anyone for the devastation that this city saw. And they're supporting him getting a sentence reduction when I was just a kid. I was literally the lowest man on the totem pole and, you know, yes, did some serious crimes, but, you know, there's this sense of kind of unfairness on their end that Rafel is the one who is getting the break here. And there's a reason for it, right? He was able to cooperate because he was so big and so connected.
He's revered.
Mm-hmm. He was able to give the government over all these years information that was useful to them. Whereas people who were young people at the time and got kind of consumed by the system they didn't know anybody. You know, they had only known the next kid up the ladder who was giving them, you know, dope to sell or put a gun in their hand or something like that. And so it's interesting to see how Rafel has become in a lot of ways a personification of that era and the impact that cocaine and crack had on the city. And I think to see it from another perspective of people who were around then and kind of fell victim to the streets in a different way.
Mm. Quickly, you said something that struck me. People who were impacted by crack and cocaine, those who are now looking for their own, watching this and hoping for their own sentence reduction, these were people who were selling crack, but not necessarily cocaine, which brings up the argument about the disparity of sentencing between rock crack and powdered cocaine. Is that also one of their concerns?
So it is to some degree, but I think actually that kind of brings up something that really kind of illustrates how crazy this period in the city's history was, is that some of my clients, and they weren't all directly involved in the drug trade. Some of it was just kind of street violence that was kind of on the periphery. But, you know, some of my clients were teenagers and were involved in wholesale drug trafficking. Obviously, you know, crack is cocaine before it becomes crack. And,
right.
You know, some of the men I've met were teenagers and were dealing in kilos of cocaine. You know, 15, 14 years old, driving a Mercedes with, you know, with a MAC-10 or an AK-47 in it. And it is just so far removed from what we know today. And certainly, I mean, I was a kid at the time and I didn't live here, so it is just another universe compared to what I've seen in D.C., but it really kind of draws that comparison out, I think.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about the Raful Edmond case, and the convicted drug kingpin is seeking a reduced sentence, indeed seeking to be released early from federal prison after more than 3 decades in prison after cooperating with authorities. And we're asking tonight, is redemption enough? Should he be released or should he remain behind bars? Before I go to the phone lines, Javeda, the title of your book, Events from the Diary of a Child of a Crack Addict, when you look at the impact that this situation has on you, what comes to mind? Your mother was a crack addict.
That's right. So she was an addict in Upper Northwest. So she bought from Morton Street. Back then it was called 640. 7th and Taylor, 3rd and Upshur, 9th and Crittenden. These were all of the drug spots that I can remember my mother running in sets of. So it affected me because I went to Barnard Elementary, then Rabaul Junior High. And so all of the drug dealers then was going, was hanging around those schools. They were picking up their girlfriends. Like you said, they was 15, 16 years old with Mercedes-Benz and 300 ZXs and BMWs. That was the thing to be. I don't know why. Police never pulled them over, asked for a driver's license. But that's what it was back then. So I would get teased because of who my mother was.
And teased by whom?
Teased by the kids in school or the drug dealers who have told their friends or their girlfriends, you know, oh, her mother's a crackhead. Mm-hmm. And my life kind of spiraled out of control as a teenager because it got to the point where when my grandparents were very prominent in the church, and so they traveled a lot. So when they were away and my mother was watching me or something of that sort, I could only date drug dealers, according to my mother. And my book talks about that.
Your grandfather was Bishop Walter McCullough.
Yes, my grandfather was Bishop Walter Sweet Daddy McCullough of the United House of Prayer. Mm-hmm. So I was left in a very upscale home, maids, being chauffeured to and from school. I mean, I was left in the best conditions. My mother didn't leave me in bad conditions, but my heart always wanted my mother.
So how did your mother get associated with that life? I mean, she grew up, like you said, with maids and all of this. How did she get lured into that?
Because, like we know, so there's that differentiation between, powder, cocaine,
crack and powder.
Mm-hmm. So my mother was the go-to person for several celebrities when they came to town.
For what?
For drugs, for powder cocaine, mm-hmm. whether they were gospel recording artists, whether they were in the limelight, she was the go-to person for that. So she kind of got caught up in it. Funny enough, my mother learned to use drugs from my uncle who came home from Lorton. Mm-hmm. And that's where she first got introduced to it.
Do you know whether or not your mother had any association directly or indirectly with Raful Edmond or his empire?
Well, I know that I don't believe that she ever had any direct association, mm-hmm. but I know that his runners were all around Morton Street, all around. Yeah. Like when we would go to, I was not supposed to be in the Black Hole, but when I was up at the Black Hole, which was Celebrity Hall, going to see Rare Essence, Go-Go at the time, and they would be running the streets. 640 was the place to be, and that's where they would get drugs from all of the time. So she dealt with a lot of his connections, but I do not believe that she dealt with him directly.
I need to go to a break, but before I go, I need to ask both James and Javeda, and I'll ask James first because we're going to lose him. Do you think Raful Edmond should be released?
I do, because, and the reason I think that is because 30 years is a long time in prison for anybody.
What about you, Javeda?
Absolutely. Everybody deserves a second chance. I mean, he's cooperated. His life is at risk even coming home because he's cooperated.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to the phone lines. Ken calling from D.C., James calling from D.C., Michael calling from Maryland. We're going to talk to you. If you're having difficulty getting through, please keep trying. Lots to discuss during the second half of the Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141. Stay with us. We will continue. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. And as I said, this conversation continues on Sirius XM, channel 141, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a moment.
University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we are talking about the Raphael Edmonds story, the convicted drug kingpin during DC's murder capital of America days. Federal prosecutors say because he's been cooperating with authorities that his life sentence should be reduced. The U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia has asked for him to be released early. Well, my guests are Keith Alexander. He's a Washington Post reporter. He covered a hearing regarding this issue today. Javeda Smith, author of Get Yourself Together First, Events from the Diary of a Child of a Crack Addict. And now joining us, Kara Ghosh, Director of Strategic Initiatives with the Sentencing Project. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Lots of calls. Let me get some of those out of the way. Ken, calling from D.C., what do you think? Ken, are you there?
Oh, yes.
Go right ahead. Quickly, what's on your mind?
Okay, first of all, this is bigger than Raphael Edmonds, because I was a police officer at the time dealing with narcotics, and I found that even during that period, you know, sure, he did what he did, but technically he was a nonviolent criminal because he didn't commit any violent acts, first of all. Second of all, a lot of the violence that was committed because I personally witnessed, you know, people going down to those military air bases down in Miami, getting guns. At the time, they were getting the 45s and flak jackets coming back from that air base, along with the military bringing the cocaine in on those airplanes. So whatever violence it was, we got to worry about glorification versus vilification.
Ken, let me stop you there, because I didn't have a chance to say that, because here's my issue, and because I was here, okay? I was here, and, you know, like Keith, he was in college, I was in college, and maybe this is an unpopular opinion, but my thing is this. Yes, Raphael Edmonds was never convicted of murder, but we do know that his empire was responsible for the murder of young black men. It was genocide. Hold on. You know that as a police officer. And we know, whether you watch Law and Order or you went to law school, that in any city where there is the death penalty, for example, and even as we are seeing changes across this nation as it relates to the death penalty, you can be the person behind the trigger and get 20 years. But if you ordered the person behind the trigger to do it, you were the one who got the needle. Okay?
Well, let me ask you this.
Okay, I'm a little, you know, hold on, I'm not finished. Because, you know, I remember when I was at my alma mater years ago, and I gave a speech to a graduating class, And my father was in the audience, and my grandfather was in the audience, and I made a comment, and I said that there are young men in Washington, D.C. who do not have the blessing of knowing their fathers or grandfathers and have them stand in the same room. Why? Because of the crack epidemic in the District of Columbia. Call me hard, but that's how I feel.
Okay, well, let's look at it from a different perspective, okay? Why did they take the trades out of the schools in the city and put the drugs in the city?
This ain't about that. This is about the crack epidemic and the violence that put blood on the street and the simple, and you're welcome to your opinion. I just disagree. But Kim, I've got to go. But I appreciate your perspective because it is a different one, and you were a police officer, so I appreciate that. But I've got to take another call. Thank you so much. Let me go to Michael. Michael, calling from Maryland. What's on your mind?
I look at it from this perspective. Let's look at the profound impact that, you know, that empire or that activity had on Washington as a whole. And let's look at how it has impacted, you know, the city from that era. I can recall walking down George Avenue on my way home, and the drug areas, excuse me, that I had to pass in order to get home was very compromising. And I look at the individuals, the houses that they ran. These were not just houses that they selected and ran them. These were individuals who were on females who had babies. They would take residents up the side of their homes to take and sell their products. And regardless if he was the one, if he pulled the trigger or not, or if he gave the order or not, his empire was behind the massive numbers running 2 and 3 years, running 400, 500, 550 murders a year. And 30 years, there are people who have committed murder that is still in prison today, that's still trying to get out, and no one is advocating for them. I don't see where he is even warranted a consideration to have a sentence reduction. No, he should not be released. We still have parents, grandparents, who are still raising children because of their daughters after his conviction became victims of crack cocaine and they're doing time now incarceration. We have more grandparents now raising children as a direct result of that. So to try to make a comparison about what drugs came from where or who was running guns wherever, we're looking at the fact that we had a nation under duress because of his empire. And we still have that same form of impact here. It may not be as prominent as it was then, but it's still prominent here. So when we look at these situations, we need to take this under very strong advisement and take it under very strong consideration.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for sharing that with me. I appreciate your passion and your opinion. Keith, you had something to say, and then I'm going to call.
Yeah, he raised a couple points I just want to just really quickly. One, D.C. Superior Court had to create a program for abandoned children and babies because parents were abandoning and walking away from their children during this time. So the courthouse had to create a program in which to care for, in which to find foster care for these children. So that's one of the things that they had to do. One of the things also that struck me was interesting was that once Edmund was convicted, then you start seeing even more violence. Why did you start seeing more violence in the street? Because everyone was now jostling to be the next Rayful Edmonds. They were trying to defend, trying to take over that territory. So you had drug dealers fighting drug dealers. So violence even escalated once Edmund was arrested. And then third, young black men walking the streets of Washington, D.C., were all often counted together by police officers because they're thinking, oh, you must be a drug dealer. You must be. I heard this from residents when I was doing a story on this. How her son and his friends walking down the street, police officers will run out and jump out, doing the jump out, assuming you're a young black man, you must be dealing drugs, you must be part of Rayful's crew. So again, other areas and other aspects of during Rayful Edmonds' time.
Yeah. And the other thing too, and I'm sure if you go back to, you know, the story archives, just because Rayful Edmonds first went to prison, his activity didn't stop.
And that's a very good point. And that also could affect whether or not he gets out of prison early. When he got convicted and went to prison in Pennsylvania, he continued to sell drugs out of prison in Pennsylvania. He got convicted of that and was sentenced 30 years. That 30 years runs consecutive to his life without parole sentence. What does that mean? Well, if he is released early here in Washington, he still has that 30-year sentence in Pennsylvania, which, according to prosecutors, they haven't even begun to even look at and decide whether or not to reduce that sentence as well.
But that's a federal charge, correct, in Pennsylvania.
And that's Kara. Gosh, please, I was going to say, please jump right in.
You know, I just want to add, you know, I work for a criminal justice research and advocacy organization, and we actually have launched a campaign to end life imprisonment. And so, obviously, I come from a certain perspective where I don't believe life without parole is ever an appropriate offense, regardless of the offense, just as I don't believe that the death penalty is an appropriate offense. Life in prison without the possibility of parole is essentially a death penalty. You are sentenced to die in prison. I want to emphasize the importance to think about what we know from research and study over decades of crime and punishment. What we know is that young men, young people who from the ages of 18 to 25 are the most crime prone in our country. Science tells us their brains are not fully developed. They are not mature enough to make, they lack impulse control. They're easily influenced by peers. And that in 30 years, people change dramatically. We know that someone in the federal prison system who is released between the ages of 51 and 60, Rafael Edmonds is 54, has one-third the likelihood of recidivating compared to the average person leaving federal prison. They are dramatically less likely to commit a new offense. They are not a significant threat to public safety. They have what we call that is a well-documented phenomenon of aging out of crime. And I think that always has to be considered when we're talking about sentence reductions, is that people do in fact age out of crime. The likelihood of them being convicted again is greatly diminished as they get older.
But even at the hearings that I've covered, that has never come up. I don't think anyone's questioning whether or not Rafael Edmonds will go back into drug dealing. The question is whether or not his cooperation merits early release based on his crimes.
Or is 30 years enough? I mean, he has served 30 years in prison. 30 years is a long time. And to me, you know, he has no other option. In this country, the federal prison system incarcerates thousands of people in their prisons who will die there. Half of those people are there for drug offenses. They have not been convicted of a violent offense. And I think that is an extreme situation. Most people who are serving life sentences in this country at the state level have been convicted of violent offenses. There is evidence. They have been convicted by a jury. They have been convicted in court. They have pleaded that they have committed a violent offense. That's not what we're seeing in the federal prison system. Half of those people are there for drug offenses.
But let me say this, and for the most part, I agree with you. Rafael Edmonds and I are the same age. Okay. So, you know, and so when you talk about, you know, minds not developed and, you know, I get that. But Rafael Edmonds, during the reporting, during the 1980s and after his arrest, was considered and probably still is considered a genius.
That's it.
Okay.
That's correct.
And the only difference between his genius and perhaps a Bill Gates or someone else is that Rafael Edmonds ran a criminal enterprise that was responsible for addiction and reputed murders and the like. And so, yes, he probably could have sat on the board of General Electric or Google. He could have, but the circumstances under which his notoriety developed did not happen. Yes, I agree that you can age out. My feeling is that because of we have situations like what happened to, you know, Gervaida's mother, for example, and all of the other people who have been affected by that, and so many boys and girls who did not know their fathers and did not know their mothers and did not know even their grandfather.
And crack babies. So
I want to hear Gervaida's thoughts about that, and then to you, Keith.
So at some point, well, just like my mother got clean, so I do believe that of course, you pay for your, you do the time, you do the crime, you pay for it. I believe that strongly. But at some point, I have to agree with her as far as aging out of it. It is, it, and it's not just about the federal system or a certain age. It has been in reports that if you do over a 5 to 7 year sentence, you are less likely to reoffend. So yes, we're not talking about racial reoffending. And I've had family members that have gotten sick, several family members that have out of my book, Get Yourself Together First, talks all about it. But out of four children, three of my grandparents' children were on crack. Three of them. Only one of them turned out to be a preacher. All of the rest of them were subject to the crack epidemic. So they didn't have their children the way they wanted their children. So yes, you feel that, but I guess the question is, when do you move on? Or do you just let him continue to be penalized for him? Or, like you said, he's going to die in prison. I mean,
Keith,
you know, one of the things that also just comes up, we talk about all the residuals. I'm just throwing everything out there. You know, let's not forget Howard University Hospital and the neonatal care. You had hundreds of babies being born addicted to crack cocaine.
My niece and nephew.
And, you know, border babies.
Mm-hmm. And which this radio station has done radiothons to help mm-hmm. support them and to provide shelter. But please go ahead.
So, again, I'm just throwing out all the various aspects of what crack cocaine did to this city. Mm-hmm. And it did more than just, I mean, you had, you know, housewives and mothers who became streetwalkers overnight. Literally, church women who became streetwalkers overnight because of this addiction. And it changed the landscape of the city and the people and their generations. That's one of the things that people just, you know, yes, I get it. It was, you know, 30 years ago. But the tentacles are still out there.
I don't think we should pretend that the drug epidemic or problem has gone away. We are in the midst of a huge opioid crisis where 70,000 people every year are dying from overdoses. This is unprecedented. I don't want anyone to think that I somehow support or endorse criminal behavior or drug trafficking. I just think we need to be strategic in how we use limited public resources. Should those resources be used to help people avoid addiction, be used to help avoid overdoses, and use a public health approach to try and address the drug crisis? Or should we be instead investing resources where you're spending $1 million over the lifetime of one individual involved in the drug trade to incarcerate them, even into old age when they no longer present a threat to public safety? Is that a good use of public resources when we already are in the midst of a drug crisis here, even in Washington, D.C.?
So let me ask you about this, because again, I have the institutional knowledge, because what you're saying right now, and I'm not saying it's wrong, what I am saying is that we've heard that before, and this is why, and I'm not talking about the $1 million. That to me, yeah, that's a valid argument about, you know, making sure that this individual is punished and it costs the state or the federal government $1 million. I get that. But during the crack epidemic, one of the main things that we heard from forward-thinking public servants was to attempt to eliminate the need for that. Because we couldn't fight it.
And the war on drugs didn't work.
Exactly. But, exactly. So they tried to come at it from the back way, instead of just eliminating and breaking down doors and cleaning up the streets. They tried to deal with it from a treatment and even and we saw what happened. Well, now.
But they haven't. There has not been the kind of resources devoted to a public health approach to address drug addiction.
What I'm saying is, first we had crack. Now we have opioids. It's the same.
It is the same
thing.
It is the same.
And so I think that, you know, the difference is that, you know, now the opioids are legally made, you know, and as opposed to, you know, coming.
Well, also in the suburbs too.
Yeah,
that's
so,
also the difference.
And even in the suburbs, the desire for these drugs is just as high and even more dangerous, even because during the crack epidemic, the crack didn't kill. It was the violence that came with it. Now we have these drugs that'll kill you with one dose. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think certainly sidebar, forgive me.
Real quick, just real quick before this, and I know I threw a lot of things, but also about a year or so ago, I tried to track down Ray Whitman. I found out that he was in witness protection, but I talked to various people, including former Attorney General Eric Holder, and people were saying what Rafel was doing inside the prisons, he's working with young people, he's mentoring young people, he's become a role model. What I'm saying is that he obviously has a story that once if he's released, maybe young people can go to him and say, well, no, hey, you know, don't go the road that I chose. But that's one of the things that he's been doing, well, obviously in addition to cooperating, but he's also, you know, mentoring young people in prison. And that was one of the things that these prosecutors wanted to get out, that he's become one of those people, because young people idolized him, right? He was in Jay-Z lyrics, he was in these movies. So he was idolized. And so he used that to really counsel and work with young people in prison. So I did want to also present that as well.
And maybe, you know, Javeda, maybe if he gets out, then he can go on the speaking circuit and make more money than he made when he was doing.
He can't go on the speaking circuit. He's going to remain. If he gets out of prison, he's going to remain in witness protection.
That was my position. Once you're labeled a snitch, and all of these people that have been convicted because of it in their discovery, whether it says witness or whatever, people know who told what on them. You know who knew what. So where is he even going to live? I mean, if he gets out of prison, he'll still be in prison. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. He can never really have a full life.
So we're suggesting that if he is released, that he would be in Iowa somewhere. I'm not being facetious. I'm serious. Iowa, Arizona.
He would have to be
away somewhere, from Missouri, right. away from the community that he left.
With a different name, a different identity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me go to James calling from D.C. James, thanks for holding on. What's on your mind?
Yeah, first I want to say I'm an author and I'm a filmmaker here in Washington, D.C., and I also written a screenplay loosely based on Ralph Wetman and his story. I did a lot of research on him, and Ralph will deserve a second chance like everyone else.
Why do you say he deserves a second chance? Why do you say that?
I mean, you have a guy that shot the president, and he's home. You have Freeway Ricky Ross. He's home. So why not let Ralph Edmond come out and get a second chance at life? And he possibly would be a good role model for some of these young people. He know what it is to be in jail for 30 years. He know what it is to have a lot of money and everything. And he would be a good person to teach some of these youth. To tell them that is not the way to go. Trust me, I've been there.
Okay.
I got the time to show.
James, thank you so much. So here's my question, Kara, because you made a really salient point. If he remains in jail, then taxpayers will continue to pay for him. But if he's released, if he's in witness protection, wouldn't they still be paying for that?
Presumably. And I don't want to, you know, this argument isn't necessarily just about Edmund Raffles, right? He's one of
them.
Excuse me.
That's all right. Go ahead.
You know, he is one of many in the work that I do. We know there are, you know, thousands and thousands of people serving life sentences. We know that the war on drugs has, you know, cost trillions of dollars over 40 years. His case is really just a symbol of a much bigger issue in this country, is in how we have decided to address drug addiction, and it has been counterproductive and ineffective.
His case has turned into a symbol of, if you cooperate with prosecutors, what do you get out of that? And if prosecutors are saying, hey, he's cooperated over 20 years, and because of that, we want to reward him. So people who are incarcerated now are looking at this closely to see, okay, what happens here? Do I need to follow the same? Do I need to do the same thing to get out? Mm-hmm. So this is going to be served as a benchmark because it is rape for women and because it is such gained such notoriety.
And I would also say, just as we were talking with James, is that not everyone has Raphael Edmonds' stature. There are people that you are talking about who, when they get out, they're not going to be in witness protection. They will be free men and women. Mm-hmm. They will be free to pursue jobs and to walk that straight and narrow, right, and right. No longer be the responsibility of the state or the federal government. In the Raphael Edmonds case, I think that is, you know, so highly unique. But yes, whether you're talking about marijuana sales, because we are seeing a huge change, a huge shift in the stigma, the criminal stigma, the social stigma attached to marijuana sales, and there are folks in prison now who maybe sold marijuana who, if they had been arrested for the same thing today, probably would have gotten a slap on the wrist.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, we need to, you know, think very broadly about how we treat drugs. I mean, it's an interesting issue of marijuana, right, with legalization coming, but people who have criminal records for marijuana sales being shut out of the industry, of the legal industry.
Exactly.
And so, you know, where is the justice there? We need to make sure that there's retroactive application that allows people to expunge their record so that they can enter into this industry, and instead it's being dominated by white, wealthy Republican former speakers of the House. So, you know, it's very broad and difficult issue, but it's something that I think that is worth the investment and time to think about constructively. How can we be most effective in reducing substance misuse and reducing overdose deaths?
Javeda, when you look back, how old are you now?
I'm 43.
You're 43. When you look back on the impact that the crack epidemic has had on your mother's life,
mm-hmm.
and on you, how did you get here from there? How did you escape the nightmare that so many people like your mom and other members of your family were enduring?
Well, I did not escape.
you're here now.
Yeah, I grew up.
Yeah.
So from the age of 11 to 15, I was promiscuous. I dated drug dealers, crack dealers, because they got me off punishment. My mother put me on punishment. This is how they got me off of punishment. And so these men were 25, 30, 35 years old. I tell you the truth, I just bumped into somebody a month ago, and we bust out laughing and said, we created the R. Kelly story. Because I was that young, and he was 20 years older than me.
Oh, Lord. Mm. We'll have to bring you back.
No, but, I mean, just realistically, because he was a big-time drug dealer down on 9th Street. But he been in prison, did his time, but he lives differently now. But needless to say, it affected me all through that. And then at 16, I found myself pregnant. And so that's what slowed me down, got me back into school, graduated with a 3.8 GPA. But that's what got me back into school. I would say if it wasn't for me having children and not wanting to be the mother that my mother was, I probably would have still been out there. Till this day, I don't smoke weed, never smoke weed, don't smoke cigarettes. I'm just afraid. I was afraid of anything that may push me into that. So that was never something for me. It was never something that I wanted. As far as who my mother is today, she's into church. She works. The thing that hurts me the most about who she'll be 70 this year, that hurts me about who she is today, is because the 24 years she spent on crack, everybody else was working.
24 years.
24 years she was on crack. So, and she got clean in 99. Mm. So the 24 years that she was on crack, everybody else was working. So now that everybody else is retired, my mother's still working.
And you could also argue that there was a lot that you missed.
It was absolutely a lot that I've missed.
In a real mother-daughter relationship.
Because my heart still wanted my mother. My heart still... The only redemption I get out of that is because my mom helped raise my baby girl and sent her off to college. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like where we kind of picked up the pieces in the end. But it does not mean that people aren't still falling victim to the same thing. I have a brother that left the area. He as long as he's here, he goes back. He'll do good for 3 years and go back into it. But now that he's in North Carolina, he does great.
I think that's a good place to end this conversation, at least for now. I want to thank all of my guests, Keith Alexander, Jervaita Smith, James Ziegler, and Kara Gosch. I really appreciate you all coming in and giving us some insight on this issue. That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Thursday, May 23rd. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.